Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Chris Hedges. He's a New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent who for two decades covered conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He returned to the United States to become a powerful social critic and critic of capitalism, and is the author of a dozen books, including Wars of Force That Gives Us Meaning, A Death of the Liberal Class, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He's a columnist for Truthdig and the host of the Emmy-nominated show On Contact on RT America. And also, and I say this every time we talk, but it's absolutely true that I think the most important public intellectual around today. So,
Derek, let me make one correction. We were all fired from Truthdig. We went on strike when the woman who bankrolled it tried to fire Bob Scheer.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down messed up intro and start over.
Okay, you can say I have a biweekly column on Scheer Post, or you can do the RT television show or something.
It's called he is a columnist for Scheer
S-C-H-E-E-R Post, and has a show on RT America. And is the host of On Contact.
Did you say the host or a host?
No, the host.
Okay, the host of...
of On Contact.
Yep, got it.
On RT America. Okay, you want to start again?
Yeah.
Okay.
excuse me. Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Chris Hedges. He's a New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent who for two decades covered conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He returned to the United States to become a powerful social critic and critic of capitalism, and is the author of a dozen books, including Wars of Force That Gives Us Meaning, Death of the Liberal Class, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He's a columnist for Scheer Post and is the host of On Contact in RT America. And also, and I say this every time I introduce him, but it's true, I think he's the most important public intellectual around today. So thanks for being on the program, and thanks for your work in the world.
Thank you.
So today I'd like to talk about an essay you recently wrote called The Politics of Cultural Despair. And it's despair is a... I've said for for decades now that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And at the same time, it can be, well, I'm just going to read the first couple sentences and have you go on from there. You write, the physical and moral decay of the United States and the malaise it has spawned have predictable results. Well, let's just go with that. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Right. So profound despair, and you're right, is a rational response when all of the avenues to self-actualization and the social bonds that give you meaning, a sense of dignity, a place within the society are ruptured. The problem is that that despair can lead to very self-destructive acts. And in my last book, America, the Farewell Tour, I lean very heavily on Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist, who studied suicide and asked the question, what is it that leads both individuals and societies to carry out acts of self-annihilation? And he, that's where you get the term anomie, which literally means rulelessness. And it means when the rules don't work anymore. So the mythology that if you go to a good school and you respect the rules of society and you work hard, there will be a place for you within that society is broken. It no longer works. And then he said, I think correctly, that that loss of place within the society is essentially thrusts you out of the protectiveness of a communal structure that was able to cope in essence, with your own impending mortality, that you lived your life or worked towards something bigger than the self. And that pushes you into a state of nihilism. And then you begin to act out in destructive and self-destructive ways. And of course, one of those ways was suicide, which I write about in my book. But there's also addictions, alcoholism, the opioid crisis, gambling. I actually wrote my chapter in that book on gambling out of the Trump Taj before it closed, before Trump even announced he would run for president, and sexual sadism, which the left, you're very good on it, but most of the left is not. And so the chapter in that book is out of kink.com, which I first heard about from you, which at the time had bought the former National Guard armory in the Mission District of San Francisco and was running what can only be called a torture center, where you live streamed into rooms and paid money to watch women being tortured, including being waterboarded. These are all pathologies of a decaying society. I think in many ways they're replicated in past societies that have fallen into decay. And so that's what this deep despair, which is, as you correctly point out, a rational response to what is around you, that's what it engenders.
So, God, that's all so rich, and I'm thinking of a line by Joseph Campbell, where he said that I'm trying to find it. Oh, here it is. For those in whom a local mythology still works, there's an experience both of accord with the social order and of harmony with the universe. For those, however, in whom the authorized signs no longer work, or if working produce deviant effects, there follows inevitably a sense of both of dissociation from the local social nexus and of quest, within and without, for life, which the brain will take to be for meaning. And am I wrong on this, or would that be sort of two sides of the same coin, where you can have, if you can move through the darkness of the despair, maybe this is too early in the interview, but if you can move through the darkness of the despair, you will find a way to find meaning in that suffering.
Not unless you rebuild social bonds in another form.
So please walk us through this, if you can.
Well, it's one of the reasons I'm such an advocate for nonviolent civil disobedience, because if you are pushed aside by the society, it is finding that community among resistors that restores social bonds and meaning that has been taken from you by the fact that you can no longer integrate within the wider society. So you can move beyond the despair, but only if you rebuild the social bonds that have been ruptured. Now, you can, one of the things that happens in a society in decay is that you can fall into what anthropologists or sociologists call poisoned solidarity. And that would be an example of that would be, you know, these right-wing militias, the three percenters, the Proud Boys. That's poisoned solidarity. So and that creates social bonds, but they're always terminal, because those social bonds are not about the nurturing and protecting of life, but the destruction of life. And I'll go back to Durkheim. He actually writes at one point about people who physically seek the annihilation of others. And he said that those feelings are always driven by desires of self-annihilation. So there is a kind of solidarity that you can find in social breakdown, but what it does is revolve itself around hypermasculinity, violence, and the destruction of the other, and the root to that is always self-destruction. So, yes, it's possible to move beyond it, but only if you rebuild another system of meaning.
So let's go back to kink.com for a moment, because you were talking a moment ago about sort of the right-wing cults of annihilation, and I don't know if you can get more annihilating than torturing women for entertainment. And so can we talk about some of the decay the decay of society, and you've mentioned the right, and you can go on about the right more if you want to, but also about the how does this manifest on what once was considered the left, and I guess is still considered the left.
Well, the left is as susceptible to these pathologies as the right. And both you and I have been very critical of the Black Bloc and parts of Antifa because, in essence, they're replicating the hyper-masculinity and lust for violence and rampant sexism that exists on the right. So when I open my chapter, it's chapter 4, on kink.com, which I'd never heard of till you told me about it. I was just floored. And it was even worse, if you can imagine, than as you described it. I quote from Wilhelm Reich, from his book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism. I'm reading his quote, "Fascism countenances that religiosity that stems from sexual perversion, and it transforms the masochistic character of the old patriarchal religion of suffering into a sadistic religion. In short, it transposes religion from the otherworldliness of the philosophy of suffering to this worldliness of sadistic murder." And of course, we're a pornified culture across the political spectrum, but we now see strong movements within the self-identified left that seeks to justify this kind of sexual sadism through pornography as a form of free speech, through, you know, what they call sex work, sexual exploitation of girls and women as a choice. This is utterly ridiculous. I come out of war zones. The only thing that wars produce in larger numbers than corpses are prostituted girls and women, so it's not an abstract phenomenon to me. But yes, it cuts across the political divide, and it has infected the left, and this is my fear. And I'm quite critical in the book about these armed, or those who yearn for an armed confrontation within Antifa, as well as these right-wing militias, and I see them. There was a great quote by an Italian scholar who said, you know, the only other good fascist is an anti-fascist.
Thank you for that. So can we back up a step? And you were talking about the inability of society to you said it better than this, but basically inability of society to, I don't want to say meet our needs, but to help us derive meaning and community, I suppose. And when I think about that, I think about Weimar Germany. I think about the fall of Rome. I don't think about this as happening overnight generally. And can you trace for us where you perceive I keep thinking about how real wages, I mean, this is ignoring the history of conquest, the history of enslavement. Let's put those aside for a moment. And in terms of real wages, I've read for a long time that they were highest in the United States about 73. So can we, where do you mark the beginning of this sort of age of cultural despair?
Well, you're right that it has deep roots because the mythology can outlast. I mean, the mythology is, it's the right word. It's always a mythology. The idea that if you work hard and you'll be rewarded with it is a mythology. But it's not completely untrue. James Baldwin, when he writes about why he supposes black middle-aged people don't have a midlife crisis the way white middle-aged people do, he posits that that's because they don't buy into the mythology. They understand as black Americans that the system is gamed against them from birth, and that they will have to struggle against a system that will never be fair. white Americans, and of course the highest rate of suicide is middle-aged white men now, buy into the mythology, and enough of it was true to not be totally discredited. But now, largely, especially for the working class, there is no place for them anymore. It doesn't matter how hard they work. It doesn't matter how much money they borrow to get a college degree. And so that triggers these kind of self-destructive actions. But yes, you're right. It takes a long time. I would say it's, you know, the most current assault would be from the early 70s. Productivity in the United States has risen since the early 70s by 77%. Wages have hardly risen at all. Wages had risen in concert with the rise of productivity, the minimum wage would be over $20 an hour. But yes, there was an assault by corporate America to crush the gains that had been made by the various movements, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, et cetera, of the 1960s. That was all verbalized in the 1971 Lewis Powell memo. Lewis Powell was the attorney for the Chamber of Commerce, who then was later appointed to the Supreme Court. He actually names Ralph Nader in the document. And then you saw corporate money, as per the Powell memo, really pumped into the culture, into academia, into the media. Now the media has been completely consolidated by corporations like Viacom and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and Comcast, and dissident voices have been completely shut out. Clear Channel. A lot of this was Clinton, because Clinton deregulated the FCC to allow about a half dozen corporations to control, I don't know what the exact figure is, but something like 90% of what most Americans watch and listen to. So yes, it was a gradual assault, an incremental assault. The destructions of unions, Reagan with the air trafficker controllers unions, even Obama, when he bailed out GM, they made a Faustian bargain, which unfortunately the union's leadership agreed to, which is that the older workers would have their pensions and benefits protected, but the younger workers could be hired for $14 an hour without benefits. So, yes, and then, of course, NAFTA, deindustrialization. It's been an incremental and slow process, but one that was very much plotted out by the oligarchs, Milton Friedman, of course, being one of the ideological Greenspan, who lauded the necessity of surplus labor, because when you have large pools of labor without work, if people attempt to unionize, like, you know, for instance, in Walmart, and they send in their strike-breaking team, which they have, to crush any kind of union activity, there's always an available pool to go out and hire new workers. That full employment is a disaster for the ruling oligarchs. They have to have large numbers of desperate people that they can prey upon, not only because it keeps wages low, but because any time laborers become restive, they can get rid of them, and they can move to those. There are always people lining up behind them who are willing to take their job without any kinds of benefits or anything else. So, yes, you're exactly right. It's been a kind of three-decade plus. If we go to the 70s, of course, that's 50. But, I mean, a decades-long assault. I think the Clinton administration did particular damage through a variety of measures, not just NAFTA, but the Omnibus Crime Bill, which exploded the prison population, militarized the police, deregulating the FCC, tearing down Glass-Steagall, the 1933 law, which put up a firewall between investment and commercial banks. Yes, this has been well thought out. It's not accidental, well planned. And this is where we are. It is the result of a concerted, organized, well-funded, an articulated effort on the part of the ruling oligarchic class to regain total control, and they have.
So one of the lessons, and thank you for that, one of the lessons that Clinton really taught me was, so I guess Reagan taught me, I came to all this late, Reagan taught me to distrust the right, and Clinton taught me to distrust the left, such as it is. And you have this beautiful line in The Politics of Cultural Despair: in America, we're only permitted to vote against what we hate. And basically, everybody I know who voted, quote, for Biden, end quote, was actually voting against Trump. And the people I've read about who were voting, quote, for Trump, for the most part, were voting, quote, against the Democrats. And that's just a beautifully succinct line. And I want to read a little bit more of that paragraph. Partisan media outlets set one group against another, a consumer version of what George Orwell in his novel 1984 called the 2 minutes of hate. Our opinions and prejudices are skillfully catered to and reinforced with the aid of a detailed digital analysis of our proclivities and habits, and then sold back to us. The result, as Matt Taibbi writes, is packaged anger just for you. The public is unable to speak across the manufactured divide. Politics under the assault has atrophied into a tawdry reality show centered on manufactured political personalities. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that's just fantastic. Do you want to talk about that, or the two-party, one-party system where it's good cop, bad cop, and both of them don't represent us? Go anywhere you want with this.
Well, I mean, this goes back to what's happened to the media. And it's very different from what Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky wrote in Manufacturing Consent. I mean, they certainly nailed it. But the media landscape has changed quite radically with the rise of the internet and 24-hour news channels and digital platforms, that we've now the commercial model of the media. You don't have three major networks that are able to impose their hegemony on the media landscape. What you have is a bifurcation of the media landscape that caters consciously to a particular demographic. So MSNBC, I mean, the Pew Research Center did a poll this summer. 95% of the people who watch MSNBC identify as registered Democrats. 91% of them, readers of the New York Times, identify as registered Democrats. I think 87% who listen to NPR identify as registered Democrats. And then I can't remember the exact figure, there's 95% who watch Fox identify as registered Republicans. And so this has infected, and I think infected some time ago, the commercial airwaves, but it's also now infected the old mainstream media organizations such as the New York Times, which slogged the whole Russiagate thing for 2 years. And then when there was no there, when almost everything Mueller and the prosecutors, all the charges found out, there was no credibility that, you know, Moscow and the Trump campaign had coordinated in the 2016 election, they immediately pivoted towards race and the 1619 project. Why? Well, that's because if they shine their journalistic lens on the inequality, austerity, gaming of the judiciary and the legislative bodies by corporate power, they would alienate the advertisers and they would alienate those on whom they depend for access. So did you see the recent job posting from the New York Times for a Moscow correspondent?
No, I did not.
I want to read it to you because I was sent to me by Stephen Kinzer, he and I were both foreign correspondents for the New York Times. And when he sent it to me, I said, come on, Steve, this is a parody. It's not real. I had to go on the New York Times website because it is real. This is a job description posted on the New York Times website for a Moscow correspondent that reads, Vladimir Putin's Russia remains one of the biggest stories in the world. It sends out hit squads armed with nerve agents against its enemies. Most recently, the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. it has its cyber agents sow chaos and disharmony in the West to tarnish its democratic systems while promoting its faux version of democracy. It has developed or deployed private military contractors around the globe to secretly spread its influence. At home, its hospitals are filling up fast with COVID patients as its president hides out in his villa. If that sounds like a place you want to cover, then we have good news. We will have an opening for a new correspondent as Andy Higgins takes over as our next Eastern European bureau chief early next year. I mean, it's unbelievable. I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years, 15 of them with the New York Times, and I thought my job was to become bicultural, which required hundreds of hours of language classes. I thought my job was to see the world from the perspective of the people I covered and reflect it back to an American audience. But all of this is now anachronistic. It's all about catering. And remember, this comes on the heels of this awful 10-part podcast that they broadcast on, you know, based on this interview with a Muslim who was identified as being part of ISIS. And he had these lurid accounts of beheadings and crucifixions where he stuck daggers in people's hearts. It was just the audio version of snuff films. It catered to the rampant Islamophobia in American society. And it was an entire lie. The Canadian RCMP arrested this guy, whose name was not Abu Huzafaya, and charged him under Canadian hoax laws for fabricating the story. That's the New York Times. Now, when that happens, the New York Times, we can critique the New York Times, and I can do it very well. It's always been an elitist publication, et cetera, et cetera. But it has now joined in this division that is gripping the entire country. And what that means is that it's not only flagrant partisanship, but it is a complete discrediting of truth. As long as you cater to the opinions of the demographic that you're attempting to address. And that has proven to be commercially quite viable. But it's extremely dangerous and is a recipe for authoritarianism because it essentially means that you rent your country apart. And they can't speak to each other. And that is exactly what happened in Weimar. And it's exactly what happened in Yugoslavia, which I covered. You had the seizure of competing media outlets in Yugoslavia by one ethnic group or another, which propagated their own version of reality and, of course, demonized the other. And that's why this is extremely dangerous.
So thank you for all that. And I know this is somewhat off the point, but another thing that bothers me tremendously about all of this quote news end quote is that when the Azerbaijan Armenia conflict started, I actually found out about that on a shitposting website, a website where they poke fun at everything, and they weren't poking fun at that. It's just I didn't hear about that on the mainstream news. And last week I was supposed to interview someone from Uganda, and the only reason I found out about the conflict and mass strife in Uganda right now is because he had to cancel the interview at the last minute because their electricity was going to be out because of riots and crackdowns. And my point is that I hear what you're saying about being bicultural, and that makes perfect sense to me. And in addition, wouldn't traditionally the job of a foreign correspondent be to go somewhere and then also simply write down what happens? Do you see what I'm getting at? As opposed to this partisan, I mean that honestly, you said like it was a parody that I would have expected that that sort of ad to be in the movie The Producers. You know, that was a joke.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, the role of a foreign correspondent or the role of anybody who attempts to be bicultural is to stand as much as you can in the shoes of those you are writing about. And that requires an understanding of their history, of their culture, of the historical and intellectual events that shape them. Because having lived overseas for 20 years, I'm acutely aware that everyone perceives reality from different cultures in a different way. And you have to translate, what it is, if you're going to Moscow, what it is how they look at the world and why, which of course requires hundreds of hours of language classes. You have to see as much as you can, or at least give them the opportunity to present their perspective on the world. And if you go over with this kind of, cartoon vision, then, why even have a foreign bureau? Why don't you hire the con artist Jason Blair and have him sit in his apartment? This is the guy who fabricated stories for the New York Times, and snort coke and write preordained narratives that the paper demands. Well, I guess you could even have algorithms do it. And that's what's so frightening. But they're so clearly catering to a particular narrative. Because remember, you have two versions of alternative reality. The Democratic Party blames everything on Russia. This will go back and look at Clinton. Even on the primary, she was warning about how Russia was grooming a female candidate, which was widely assumed to be Tulsi Gabbard, to run as a third-party candidate and be a Russian Manchurian candidate. She accused Jill Stein in 2016, the Green Party candidate, of being a Russian asset. That's in quotes. She has and continues to insist that although Mueller and his prosecutors found no evidence against the charge, Trump worked with Moscow closely during the 2016 campaign and WikiLeaks, which she says is a Russian front. And at the same time, of course, you've got Giuliani and Trump arguing that it's Venezuela and communists who had that bizarre press conference where Giuliani's hair dye was dripping down his face or whatever it was, talking about how we were using Venezuelan voting machines that had been set in place by Hugo Chavez to steal the election. In the meantime, the real force that interferes in American elections, Israel, is never mentioned by either party. And Israeli lobbying groups pump millions of funds into American political campaigns. They fly members of Congress and their families to these junkets at Israeli seaside resorts. You had in 2015, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu actually went before Congress without even informing or asking Barack Obama to attack the Iran nuclear deal. All of that dwarfs, an intrusion by any other country, including, of course, Russia. But that's not mentioned. And so what you have is alternative realities peddled by the two ruling elites who are all they do is fight over the spoils of power while serving corporate interests. And then these alternative realities are amplified by these partisan media outlets. And if you, in fact, you quoted, read that thing with Matt Taibbi, who's been probably the best, he and Glenn Greenwald, but it's probably Matt, on the major censorship, which was very heavy during the campaign. In favor of Biden by the major digital platforms. Which were like, cutting the New York Post off from its own website when it tried to report about the emails on Hunter Biden's discarded laptop. This is very ominous for those few journalists that remain that don't fall on one side of the partisan divide or another, and that attempt to hold the Democratic Party accountable in the same way that they hold every other party accountable.
An example of that censorship that kind of struck me was that back in March, Trump refused to reauthorize the Patriot Act. And his reasons for doing so were, I think, kind of stupid. But nonetheless, he did not allow the Patriot Act to be reauthorized. And I didn't actually hear about that until a week before the election. And that, again, was just some weird website. It was not from mainstream news. And for 15 years or for however long, the Patriot Act was a bogey of the left.
And so was campaign finance. Remember? But not when Obama ran, not when Biden runs. Biden got quite a significant amount of corporate money. It was far larger than even given to Trump.
And I think for both of us, this is not an argument about Trump or Biden, which is, I think, to miss the point. But instead, it's about we as people need information in order to make informed decisions by definition. And silly me, I would have thought that the press had as one of its roles the provision of information as opposed to providing you with a thriller lurid tale of Russia.
Right, but that's not profitable. So it's all about profits and readership. And you have – this is, of course, what drives the electronic media, but it drives the New York Times. The New York Times has been devastated with the decline of print and with the fact that advertisers can now, through digital profiles, connect directly with consumers. They don't need the traditional medium of the press in order to connect. And so I think that is the driving force that has corrupted journalism. I mean, journalism, that's another show. I mean, there's always tremendous problems with mainstream journalism. I remember Sidney Shamberg, once a great journalist who was fired from the New York Times. He was the person in the killing fields. Anyway, he was pushed out of the Times for challenging the developers that were destroying Manhattan. And he said, well, you know, the New York Times may have never made anything better, but sometimes it helped stop things from getting worse. That's kind of the best definition I've heard of the New York Times. But yes, I'm very worried. You know, because these are fictional narratives. And what it is really, it is destroying so you have a political elite that's destroying the credibility of democratic institutions and electoral politics. But you have a press that's destroying the whole concept of news and facts. Nothing is true or false. Information is either embraced or discarded based on whether it hurts or promotes one faction or another. And, you know, we saw this during the Biden campaign in all sorts of ways with, you know, very flagrant forms of censorship, and not just in terms of the laptop, but, you know, any rumor, however unsubstantiated, that hurt Trump was given massive play. But anything that might hurt Biden was shut out. I mean, even when they referred to the John Podesta emails, I mean, a lot of it stems from the 2016 campaign when those emails were released by WikiLeaks and widely reported on. Remember, they had all sorts of damaging stuff to Hillary Clinton in there, how she pushed the war in Libya because she thought it would burnish her presidential credentials, how she was telling Wall Street we're getting $675,000 to give three speeches to Goldman Sachs and telling the billionaire class that you know, they would run the economy, which was in direct contradiction to what she was saying in her campaign. And so they really, I think, stepped up to, in essence, make amends. And so when Biden, you know, that tape was released of Biden speaking to the former Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, which, as far as we can tell, was authentic, it was completely sidelined. You had the New York Times calling the Podesta emails misinformation. That's a quote, when, of course, they were real. And then you had the whole stuff around Hunter Biden's laptop. And you had, you know, this is not just the Times. Glenn Greenwald who tried to write on the information on the Hunter Biden's laptop was censored by his editors at The Intercept. And there's no doubt about it, because he released the traffic back and forth over the article. And so how do the editors and writers at The Intercept react? They ignore the textual evidence. And all they do is engage in a pretty vicious campaign of character assassination against Greenwald. And I find that breakdown of journalism, I mean, of course, it's what I come out of, very frightening and very reminiscent of what happened in Yugoslavia. When a society loses the capacity to communicate one to the other and demonizes the other and uses the rhetoric of hate and then eventually violence, then that's a very short step to actual violence. And we've already seen in Portland it take place. We had the attempt by these militia members to kidnap the governor of Michigan and Virginia, actually put them on a kind of kangaroo court and execute them. I mean, eventually, these people are, one of these groups, they're going to succeed. I mean, it's going to work. And once you open that Pandora's box, especially when you have huge elements clustered around the Black Bloc and Antifa who are infected with the same disease, and of course anybody can go to a local Walmart and buy an assault weapon, then you're in deep trouble.
So this is one of the reasons I keep extolling you as one of the greatest public intellectuals, is paragraphs like this. Freud, like Primo Levi, got it. The moral life is a matter of circumstances. Moral consideration, as I saw in the wars I covered, largely disappears in moments of extremity. It is the luxury of the privileged. 10% of any population is cruel no matter what, and 10% is merciful no matter what, and the remaining 80% can be moved in either direction, Susan Sontag said. I think you and I share concern is way too weak a word, a concern for this, I don't think devolution is the word, but I'm going to use it. I think both of us share a concern for what's going to happen as these moments of extremity expand.
Yeah, I'm frightened. I mean, I've seen it. I've smelled it. I know what it looks like. I know what its antecedents are. And we're playing a very dangerous game of self-immolation. And my fear with the Biden administration is they're going to go back to what they call normal. Well, that's good for the technocrats on the West Coast and the East Coast, but it's very bad for the rest of the country. Things are, of course, about to get worse. The University of Washington is now estimating that by February, there will be 500,000 American dead, 400,000 by January. Chronic unemployment, which, as you know, in real figures is far closer to 20%, because people who stop looking for work, people who are furloughed but aren't going to be rehired, people who work part-time but are still below the poverty level, are all included, they're included in the official statistics as being employed, or they're erased, in the case of people who stopped looking for work. So or people who are furloughed and aren't going to be rehired are not counted as unemployed. So this is going to be exacerbated because unemployment benefits are going to run out the end of the year. The supplemental benefits have already run out. You have this bifurcation with the professional class able to stay at home and many of them in New York. New York's empty on the Upper East Side because they've all gone to the Hamptons or somewhere. And then the frontline workers, which are dying at disproportionate rate, often poor people of color, almost 50% of whom aren't even eligible for sick pay. Millions of Americans, we don't have an exact number, but perhaps as high as 40 million have lost their employer-sponsored health insurance. You have food banks overrun. You have 10 to 14 million renter households. That's about 34 million people that were unable to pay their rent in September. That's about $17 billion in unpaid rent. That figure is expected to rise by $34 billion in past due rent by January. So what happens, as we've done, when you lift the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures? That means these people, millions of people, will be thrown into the streets. And at the same time, hunger in households has tripled since last year. This is according to the Department of Agriculture, by the way. The proportion of American children that don't have enough to eat is 14%, from the same study, is 14 times higher. And Columbia University just came out with a study that said that there are now 8 million more Americans who can be classified as poor. And meanwhile, you know, the for-profit healthcare industry is making record profits. The billionaire class has increased their wealth. I don't know what the latest figure is, but the last one is about $500 billion. I think Bezos by $30 billion. The 50 richest Americans have as much wealth as half the country. And you know who's suffered disproportionately is not only poor people of color, but millennials, which is about 70 million people. They only have an estimated 4.6% of U.S. wealth. So what do we think is going to happen? I mean, the Biden administration has made it very clear whose interests they are going to serve. That's why you had all this money, especially from Silicon Valley, in these super PACs that produced all these negative Trump ads on behalf of Biden. They know who's going to serve their interests. We fault Trump, as we should, for his ineptitude over Corona. But the fact is the for-profit healthcare industry has devastated the healthcare industry, not just in terms of jacking up prices and of pharmaceuticals and everything else, but consolidating and closing access to medical care. We have less than 1 million hospital beds in rural communities and poor communities. Hospitals have been closing left and right in the hundreds. So people can't even get care. They can't afford care. There's no coordinated national effort to deal with the pandemic that's out of control. We have a constant shortage of protective equipment and, ventilators and masks and everything else. And hospitals and states have to bid against each other to get it. It's a complete mess. And so all of these problems, which are systemic problems, are not going away under Joe Biden.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I have a couple, three questions. The first one is that that all those statistics you cited are, I think, incredibly important. And I think also we can see the same thing by traveling through, not even traveling, just going, I don't know about where you live, but where I live, if you go into town, like probably one out of three or four or five shops are empty. And this is not a short-term problem. This has been going on for a long time, and it's just getting worse. And this is true not just here, but in other towns too that I've seen. And then this makes me think of Mumford's huge question and answer about why has our age surrendered so easily to the controllers, the manipulators, the conditioners of an authoritarian technics? And he says that the answer is a magnificent bribe, that present-day technics has accepted the basic principle of democracy that every member of society should have a share in its goods. And so by at least promising to give, and this goes back to the Baldwin quote, at least promising to give some members of society, a significant percentage of society, a share of the goodies, you can then, you being the leaders, the controllers, can do whatever they want. But it seems to me that what we're seeing is the failure of the magnificent bribe, because no longer can those promises be kept at all.
Yes, that's a very good point. So this is Sheldon Wolin's point in his very fine study, the last book he wrote, Democracy Incorporated, that essentially you use cheap consumer products, access to credit, because most people live on credit, as a bribe. And I remember asking him before he died, and he's probably our most important contemporary political philosopher, precisely that question. What happens when people don't have access to that bribe? He coined the term inverted totalitarianism, by which he means that it's not classical totalitarianism. You still have the facade, like the late Roman Republic. You still have the Congress and the courts and the press. But internally, corporations have seized all of the levers of power. And I said, well, do you flip? Do you get a more classical form of totalitarianism? And he said, yes, probably. And I think that what we're seeing now is that shift away from those forms of social control to the more traditional draconian forms of social control that typify tyrannies. That's mass incarceration. We have 25% of the world's prison population. We are 4% of the world's population. Most of those people are those Marx would term surplus labor, those who have been cast aside in deindustrialized urban centers, and then militarized police, which are function as occupation forces, and finally wholesale surveillance. And Hannah Arendt, in Origins of Totalitarianism, she herself loses her German passport and is expelled to France, but she's stateless. She has no national identity. She has an identity, but she has no national papers. She is not a citizen legally anywhere. And she said that when any society allows a group of people to be severed from, the inclusion within that society, which we've certainly done, of course, to our undocumented population, then you build both physical and legal mechanisms by which rights become privileges. Rights can be taken away. And in a moment of social upheaval, you already have both the physical infrastructure and the legal infrastructure to do that to everyone else. And that's precisely what I think is happening.
So the next to last question is you write near the end of this essay, the most difficult existential dilemma we face is to at once acknowledge the bleakness before us and act, to refuse to succumb to cynicism and despair. And we will do this only through faith. We will only do this through faith, the faith that the good draws to it the good, that all acts that nurture and protect life have an intrinsic power, even if the empirical evidence shows that things are getting worse.
So that would be my definition of faith, which doesn't require anybody to have a religious ideology. I happen to come out of a religious tradition, but it doesn't require you to have one.
You know, go ahead.
I mean, even empirically, if everything says otherwise, and the Buddhists call it karma, I believe that the good does draw to it the good, and we may not even see it within our own lifetime. But I think we do have to find that faith if we're going to resist, especially at this moment.
And in addition, we actually don't know the future. So even though things look bleak, there have been many times in history when things were very bad, and then there would be some sort of resistance arise.
Yes, and I think also we can't even hold out the possibility of hope if we don't resist. It's that what Auden called that ironic point of light, because it is about all. It's not just about resisting. It is about protecting and nurturing and transmitting that other narrative that fights against the dominant narrative. That's a fundamental component of resistance. Remember, Gramsci, who was so important in terms of a theorist, in terms of cultural control, was imprisoned by Mussolini and died in prison under fascism, he himself personally. And yet, look at the resonance and the importance of what he wrote.
And the same with Sophie Scholl. She was beheaded, but she influenced me. She may have influenced you. Henning von Treskow, anybody. They don't live embodied, but they still live. We're holding hands through time.
Yes. And, there's, I think it's Svetlana Todorov calls them invisible witnesses. And oftentimes those are personal relationships, people who sacrificed and resisted at great personal cost. And even though they're long gone, when it comes time for you, you can't betray them, or you shouldn't. You shouldn't betray them. You can't betray them, and that forces you to act, even though their life could be defined, I suppose, as a failure. I mean, Faulkner wrote, "Every life seen from the inside is a failure." Even if it's defined as a failure, and years later, the power of their act informs other acts.
So thank you so much for that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Chris Hedges. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.